If you're a Thomist, you're going to be slightly disappointed with my talk tonight. If you're not a Thomist, you may also be slightly disappointed with my talk tonight, but for maybe different reasons. This is not going to be a sharply analytical paper. It's going to be a series of reflections about the meaning of education, miseducation, and perhaps how to reform our loves so we can be educated correctly. And I hope we'll have ample time for conversation afterwards and for your objections and queries and so on. Please don't hold back your criticisms. A few years ago, in a widely noted essay, William Dworsiewicz warned that the nation's top colleges were turning our students into zombies. While Dworsiewicz noted that many of his students at Yale were bright, thoughtful, creative kids, most of them seemed content to color within the lines. Very few, he said, were passionate about ideas. Very few saw college as part of an intellectual discovery. He continues, "Everyone dressed as if they were ready to be interviewed at a moment's notice." In another famous essay by David Brooks, he reports one Princeton student as saying, "Sometimes we feel like we're just tools for processing information. That's what we call ourselves, power tools." Now, I know that Yale and Princeton students aren't cavaliers and so naturally are upset with their lot in life. But I wonder if you might recognize something in yourself of Dworsiewicz's description of students who are driven, accomplished, talented, disciplined, successful, and capable, and yet, as he continues, look beneath the facade of seamless well-adjustment, and what you too often find are toxic levels of fear, anxiety, emptiness, and aimlessness, and isolation. The prospect of not being successful terrifies and disorients these students. Or, as Mark Schiffman, a friend of mine and chair of the humanities program at Villanova, puts it, contemporary students are majoring in fear. Says Schiffman, Hunger Games is, of course, the novel of the generation. The trilogy, Hunger Games, depicts adolescents rigorously trained by adults for desperate but meaningless life or death competitions. That's his description of the contemporary university. Its dark emptiness, Hunger Games, resonates with students' latent unease and dissatisfaction with their educational regimen. A friend of mine, a student at Princeton, told me just last week, the emperor has no clothes. Latent dissatisfaction with their educational regimen, as well as with the worry that they're all honed up with no place to go. Afflicted with a desperate compulsion for competitive advantage, they rack up majors, minors, certificates, credentials, and internships to keep them in the running for what they feel to be an ever more elusive success. They're driven by fear. They major in fear. Now, I hesitate to say it, but perhaps there's something missing. Perhaps this is not a life lived particularly well. And note that these descriptions are not the lives of college students only, but really of many Americans. Hurried, anxious, uncertain of purpose. Students, it seems to me, are simply mirroring their parents, imitating their mentors. For many of us are like this now. That is, we're not entirely sure what we're for. And since we're not sure what the purpose of life is, what would make for a life well lived, we opt instead for accomplishment, success, racking up awards, those visible marks that we're doing well, even if we're not so sure that we are well. Now, one reason for this, presumably not the only reason, is that we live in a disenchanted world. For us moderns, the cosmos is no longer full of spirits and gods, fairies and forms, but only causal forces that we harness to our own needs. While this allows for an unprecedented technical and economic progress, it can also lead to a wide sense of malaise at the disenchanted world, a sense that the world is flat or empty or devoid of ultimate purpose. As the philosopher Charles Taylor puts it, this entails a vision of life which accepts no final goals beyond human satisfaction or of any allegiances to anything beyond this satisfaction, where that satisfaction is defined reductively as pragmatic, utilitarian, and technological. That is, there really is nothing more to life than the next iPhone and the returns promised for economics, medicine, health, and well-being. As a result, the range of our competence, not just as thinkers and students, but as humans, has shrunken to the technical, even while our natural human concerns for meaning and purpose continue unabated. But because we're not sure that there is anything beyond the technical, we turn to the technical and to success and to the practical to satisfy our concerns for meaning. But the next iPhone, the rising GDP, and a corner office, while good, just aren't up to the task of providing ultimate meaning. Although a few people seem to think that their phone may. As a result, we're jittery. We're consumed with the diminishing returns of frantically making new iPhones in bigger corner offices. Repeat endlessly and frenetically. Now, the governing questions for us are not as they were for the ancients. What are we for? What is being for? But instead, how do things work? So reduced, the human things are fundamentally altered. The drama of forming one's own character with its risk and danger, possibility and wonder, transforms into something more like an owner's manual of maintenance schedules and self-improvement. Even death, once thought the great equalizer and some sort of metaphysical mystery to grapple with, as Yuval Harari has recently noted, has lost all of its religious and metaphysical meaning. It's now understood as just a hardware glitch, a problem to be solved. Death, Harari says, is optional. We can fix death, so we should. It's just a problem to solve like any other problem, and hardly a mystery in need of redemption. Now, this vision is also, I suggest, why there's so much anxiety about our lives. Believing neither in creation or providence, the world for many of us is now one of stark and empty power. And while its powers and causes can be harnessed and used to our advantage, these powers are not ordered or directed by any particular reason or for any particular end. In the end, our power is limited by nothing other than our own imaginations. Consequently, and I think somewhat oddly, we increasingly, or I do, experience our freedom as both an empowering emancipation and as a source of anxiety. For now, it's all up to us. When there is failure, it is we who have failed. There's no acts of God to blame. There's no wheel of fate to blame. Our freedom means that we are, you are, responsible for everything. But responsible for what exactly? What are you to do exactly with your freedom? What am I for? What am I to do? Now, not knowing, many of us turn our freedom to what we do know how to do, accomplish things, and thus prove to ourselves and to others that our freedom has merit, that we matter, that we have worth, that we are doing well. Does any of this ring true? I hope not, but I suspect that it does. Does any of this ring true to students? We've been let down. May I tell you a story? One that I think is true. It starts like this, in the beginning. You know the story in Genesis 1. In the beginning, God creates things. You don't have to read, you can read this in a variety of ways. I think it's essentially true, and what it reveals morally is true. We can quibble about its historicity if you want. I actually think it's historically true, too. God declares that all things are good, and he takes great delight in it. Do you know that story, that account from Chesterton, where Chesterton asks why the sun rises every day? Of course, the sun doesn't really rise, but why the sun rises every day? Do you know Chesterton's explanation for this? Because God is like a big child who screams again and again because he's so excited at the good things that he has made. Now, for Thomists, this all makes good sense. For God is his own existence, and everything other than God is ontologically different from God and thus only contingent. Everything other than God has existence, while God is his own existence. But anything that has existence cannot be the cause of its own existence. But existence is not merely like life, not the function of a system that can sustain itself. To be, for us and for every contingent thing, is to be willed to exist by God, not just once, as in deism, but at every moment of existence. Now. 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 Our own existence is like the light from the lights above. If we turn off the power, the light goes out. If for even a moment God stopped existing or stopped caring or stopped willing the unique act of your existence just now, you would not die, you would not be. You would return to the nothingness from which you came. Now, what this means is that the world is not flat. It is charged with the grandeur of God. He even now speaks it into being. He still sees that it is good. He still delights in it. It is not at all flat or disenchanted because the universe is a free gift from God, a self-donation from a being who need not create. He gains nothing from creation. He has no internal compulsion which forces him to create. The universe is a gift. And because it is a gift, and only because it is a gift, can we declare that it is very, very good. So the universe is not flat. That's Genesis 1. That's all fine. But consider for a moment Genesis 2, where the story changes from metaphysics to persons. Some of you who know me know I love this chapter of the scriptures and like to repeat the two things I know about it endlessly, so bear with me. In Genesis 2, we're given the account of real persons, Adam and Eve. In Genesis 1, we have unnamed male and female. In Genesis 2, we have characters who emerge, Adam and Eve. And yet, startlingly into the story, after Genesis 1 has told us repeatedly that things are good and good and good and very good, God declares that the world is not good. Something is wrong. Anyone remember what is not good? It is not good for man to be alone. Now, has Adam recognized that himself? No, God has recognized that. Now, as I and others read the story, God is attempting to educate Adam into a recognition that Adam does not yet have, that it is not good for Adam to be alone. And you remember the story. It's very winsome. It's the sort of story that when you read it aloud to your children and you wait for them to ask the questions about the meaning of the story, you're not sure what you're going to say to them. Remember the story? God parades the animals past Adam. Adam names the animals. And God is attempting, in my read, to train Adam that Adam is alone in the world and that it is not good for him to be alone. Now, you'll give me a moment of dramatic whimsy here. Sort of imagine Adam being told by God that God is going to find him a helper, suitable to him, one like him, one for him. Here comes the giraffe, and Adam says, nice, but too long of a neck, move on. Here comes the elephant, and Adam's like, that's intimidating, move on. Here comes the platypus, Adam's like, yeah, no, right? Now, this is off very much like a Friday night on a college campus, is it not? One comes by, not for me, swipe right. Another comes by, not for me, swipe right. Another comes by, swipe right. Now, if you've had an experience like that, you know that at some point, the experience changes from, is there one right for me, to something more profoundly unsettling, which is, am I right for anyone or for anything? Now, as I read the story, God is training Adam. This is a pedagogy for Adam. For Adam to recognize that he is alone and that it is not good to be alone. You remember the story? Adam's put to sleep. The rib is taken. Whatever's going on in that story, the rib is taken. Adam awakes. There is Eve. And Adam has this wonderful response. At last. Bone of bone and flesh of flesh. One like me. Bone of bone and flesh of flesh. One equal to me. One for whom I am. One who is for me. Now, could Adam have rejected Eve? Could he have said, no thanks. Where's Lilith? If you know that story. Could he have swept right and said, where's Lilith? Of course. Now, if Adam had rejected Eve, if he had said, not at last, with a delight which is reminiscent of God's own delight, of God's own recognition that things are good in Genesis 1, if he had said, not good, what would that have meant for Adam? Well, I think it would have meant that Adam would not only have rejected Eve, but he would have rejected God. Because what God is trying to demonstrate and reveal to Adam is that Adam, in an analogous way to God, or Thomas, some of us here, in this analogous sense, that Adam, in an analogous way to God, is meant for communion and for self-gift. Such that if Adam had rejected Eve, he not only would have rejected Eve and God, he would have rejected his very own being. Because Adam would have declared that what I am is for myself first, that I am not for self-donation. The task, then, that Adam is given is to see Eve, to see the world, and to see himself in a manner like how God sees the world, namely with delight, joy, welcome, and self-donation and gift. Now, as I understand the way we are now and the way that we are increasingly trained in our society, we struggle to believe this. I don't mean we struggle to believe Genesis 1 and 2 as historical events. I mean something more difficult. We struggle to believe that reality is good in this way, and we struggle to look at the world as a gift. And we struggle to look at others and ourselves and joyfully say, at last. Not only in our work and our study do we have the opportunity to offer the gift of ourselves to the world, but we struggle to do so, and many of our institutions are not training us how to say, with great delight and joy, at last to the work. According to Joseph Pieper, someone whom I love very much, we now struggle to see reality as good or wonderful or joyous. Not, he insists, that we are physiologically impaired, although we are perhaps overwhelmed by the sheer amount of how much there is to see. Instead, he says, the very integrity of human existence is threatened by what he refers to as existential poverty. This poverty is what I meant earlier by the replacement of fundamental concerns, what am I for, with relative concerns which are reductive, like how do I attain and accomplish. Now, it is not only that we refuse to look at the world, Pieper says. Even if we decided to look, we would not see, for our power to see is impaired. He doesn't mean physiological sight. He means to see goodness, and will remain so unless sight is restored. Seeing, in this sense, like Adam saw Eve, requires a basic attunement with the world, a being attentive or attending to the real and the true. And unless one knows how to see the good, unless one knows how to see the true, unless one knows how to see the beautiful, our basic human nature will tend to shrivel rather than to thrive and to flourish. So what to do? It seems to me, and here's what I'll suggest for you, is that the basic task of education is not to accomplish, but to teach us to affirm the goodness of the world, even as God does. For this, we require a change of viewpoint, a change from the frantic desire to do and to have, to rack up accomplishment. Traditionally, in education, pride of place has been given not to work and to accomplishment, but to leisure. You'll remember that the word school itself means leisure. Your main task, while at the University of Virginia, is leisure. Some of you are smiling like the absurdity of that statement, yes? Grandpa, I need $45,000 a year for leisure. Now, not to be confused with simple downtime, genuine leisure is not non-activity. It is instead a mental and spiritual attitude, an attunement to the goodness of the real. It is a condition of the soul rather than merely the external condition of having time to kill. Leisure is possible only when we confidently approve of the integrity of the created world as good. It is a kind of radical openness to the real with a kind of deep amazement and approval. It is good that the world is here, and leisure is in a kind of celebration of the goodness of the world. And it requires contemplation. If you know Thomas, you know that Thomas views the contemplative life as higher than the active life, and his contemplation is something like what the relationship with God will be fundamentally in the end. I'm not suggesting that's true without argument. I'm suggesting that the tradition has thought of contemplation as a remarkable and important virtue to have. Now, if you're like me, I suspect that you imagine that contemplation is a kind of withdrawal from the world into the enclosing reserve of one's own self, generally in a kind of stultifying silence. Any of you afraid of the idea of contemplation? It sounds quite awful. It sounds stultifying. Now, it is true that contemplation requires attentiveness, but contemplation steps away from the hustle, not into withdrawal and not into passivity, but into a kind of active receptivity, an engagement, a reaching out to things with a loving acceptance and an affectionate affirmation. It is not a shrinking back from the world so much as a recalibration, a making visible that which has been overlooked but which was always there to see, namely the goodness of the world which is recognized through love. Ubi amor, ibi oculus. The eyes see better when guided by love. This is true in romance. It's true in study as well. Contemplation is not a passive indifference, nor a stifling, nor a cessation of activity, but an activity of a particular kind and of a particular intensity. It is a determined reaching out to the world in expectant alertness. It is a celebration which draws vitality from love. Just as God ends his work in Genesis by affirming the goodness of his work, so contemplation actively celebrates. We look for goodness. We affirm goodness. We celebrate goodness. And I mean the goodness of the world, that it is. Nor should we think of the celebration as some recondite accomplishment of the mystic. Not at all. The highest form of affirmation, says Pieper, which he thinks is available to everyone, is the festival. For Pieper, the true contemplative in public is someone who knows how to feast. But when's the last time you feasted?
Sunday.
When's the last time you had a real feast day? I brought home Zeppoli di San Giuseppe on Tuesday for my children. Zeppoli are Italian cakes for St. Joseph's Day. And we feasted on them because it is good. No other reason. Now, a feast day as opposed to an ordinary day of work. In ordinary labor, we are concerned that effort accomplishes something. Effort which accomplishes nothing in labor is pointless. It's fruitless. Toiling away at some task without accomplishment would be failure, maybe even unintelligible and irrational. But in festivity, the whole notion of success or failure is irrelevant, since one does not fail at feasting except by trying to accomplish something with the feast. Pieper says that concern for success or failure of an act falls away. Insofar as one feasts merely in order to feast, one has succeeded at feasting because one has done something for its own sake. One has escaped the utilitarian domain of toil and done something merely because it is good to do. It is to be careless. To expand effort and energy without success or payoff, it is not to assume that you will be paid back. But festivity is free because we do it expecting nothing in return other than the meaning and purpose of that action in itself. Now, students, you've studied this way. I know you have, and I know you know the difference. You've studied out of sheer interest, sometimes even at the expense of something you ought to be studying for class. It's delightful. You know how the hours whiz by when you're doing something, when you're studying something you really wish to study? You've had this experience? You've had that experience of contemplating the one whom you love or hope would love you? You know how the hours go by and it's so effortless? You've also studied something which is done sheerly for utilitarian purposes. You know how slowly the time can go? You've been on that first date that you would like to get out of, but you're doing it as a favor to your brother. You know how slow that conversation goes. Feasting is effortless, even though it is an activity, not a withdrawal. And it's delightful. Feasting makes an offering of its labor, its sacrifice, suffices without hope of return. But it can do so, says Pieper, because it is existentially rich. Those who are existentially poor act only if they believe that there will be a return. Those who are existentially rich can act without hope of return, and in fact can act while giving. Thus, it is only the lover who wills and approves the goodness of the world in a complete and ultimate way. Only the lover who can celebrate like this. And this kind of festivity requires love. Ubi caritas guadat ibi est festivus. Where love rejoices, there is festivity. Celebration cannot occur without willing the world as God sees it, without loving its goodness. In fact, it seems to me, God's very nature is celebratory. God's very nature is an endless dance of mirth. The Father loves the Son, and the Son loves the Father, and the Holy Spirit is the procession of love between the two. That is more like dance or more like a kiss than the shamrock or the apple or the triangle or the other static images that we often use. The nature of God is more like an endless celebration than anything else. But that cannot happen unless we see reality as being good. My suggestion for you is that however much we have material goods and benefits in our own time, many of us are unable to celebrate a feast, and that many of us are somewhat barren or existentially poor. So, how can we become existentially rich? How can we become lovers who see what is good and delight in it and do all of our work in this way? How do we become contemplatives when there's just so much to do, when we're so busy, and even worse, when we're so existentially poor? As an aside, I think this is a question you should ask yourself frequently. Is your education making you rich or poor existentially? Are you majoring in love or are you majoring in fear? So, how to become existentially rich? First, books. Your students, after all. Most of my own teaching has been in great books programs, committed to helping students learn to pull up a chair with the greatest minds. But it seems to me more obvious than ever, although I find this sad, that in moments of cultural confusion and dissolution like our own, it's incredibly difficult to become at home with the great books. So prior to and alongside the reading of the great books, we need to become friends with many, 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 perhaps hundreds of the good books. Good books may not be those texts around which a civilization is built and about which a civilization argues. Not all every great book is one that we agree with. Many of them we disagree with. We just continue to disagree with it, and so it becomes foundational in some way. Not every great books would be things like Sophocles, the Bible, Plato, Aristotle, Shakespeare, Cicero, and others. The good books, on the other hand, train us or allow us to inhabit, to dwell, to live and breathe in the world of the greats and giants when we, who are neither great nor giant, are existentially poor. This is what we do with children, do we not? We train them to be able to live with things beyond them. During a time in which many cannot see, it is possible that they must become gradually accustomed to the light. So we first read living or good books to bring life to souls. Sometimes those souls are little and need to grow, and sometimes those souls are blind and need to learn to see. Or perhaps to taste. Taste might be a better metaphor. The need to develop the taste for the true, the good, and the lovely. In fact, the Latin word for wisdom, sapientia, shares a root with the word for taste, such that to have wisdom is to have a kind of good taste for the right things. So the first and most important gift that we can give is a kind of moral taste, a kind of moral imagination, the wisdom to be able to apprehend what is good, especially by drawing upon the emotions, well-formed, educated, reasonable emotions, which tend almost always to be formed by stories, images, or symbols. C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man puts it this way, quote, "Without the aid of trained emotions, the intellect is powerless. I'd sooner play cards against a man who is quite skeptical about ethics, but bred to believe that a gentleman does not cheat, than against an irreproachable moral philosopher who had been brought up among sharpers. In battle, it is not syllogisms that will keep the reluctant nerves and muscles to their post in the third hour of the bombardment." Why are you educated, especially if you're seeking liberal education? Anyone who values the liberal arts will know that it is not to attain a degree. It is not to make money. Certainly is not going to happen if you're studying the liberal arts. It is not to attain honor. It is not to avoid working with one's hands and so forth. Those are all mistakes to avoid. What ought to be the case is that liberal arts exist not to form intellects primarily. They exist to form persons who love well. As the former chancellor of one of my own alma mater, Boston College, he puts it this way. In Jewish and Christian biblical tradition, the measure of a man or a woman was never to be found in the magnitude of their intellectual attainments. That measure was to be found rather in how sensitively, how responsibly, they exercised his or her freedom. How many of you have been involved in education for much or most of your life, which has been about intellectual attainment as opposed to the responsible exercise of freedom? Well, then you have not been liberally educated, and we've let you down. We educate for the enriching and constructive exercise of our own freedom. That is, to shape humans capable of wisdom about what is good to do and love and see. And that requires, as Lewis puts it, trained emotions. And those emotions, I think, come from stories that the good books provide us. With my own children, I like to read them stories about naughty Peter Rabbit, about the heroes and villains in Plutarch, about brave little toy canoes that make their way down streams and through rivers to get to the ocean, about persistent turtles and Aesop. Those are all living tales, not only in the sense of being interesting or captivating, but in teaching how we go about living well. A just education, and one that I think you should ask for, is one which begins with good books so that your tastes and imaginations can be well formed. Because in the end, a bookish education is not about knowing books so much as is sometimes suggested. We shouldn't be trying to become pedants, but rather persons. The point is to live well, not merely to be well-read. That was one, read good books. Second, develop a healthy ability to waste time. Now, this is a kind of heresy, I imagine, for many of you. Some of you have blocked out in some app today 15-minute increments of things to do. Develop a healthy ability to waste time. To waste it well. Big difference. Ours is the age of efficiency and technique, of time management and multitasking and Twitter and Netflix and cable news networks and Wikipedia and YouTube and 1,000 other frantic spectacles and devices. Faster, more quickly, quickly now, manipulate the data, publish the data, read the blog, comment on the news story, keep up to date, text a friend. Helpless in that milieu is an education system incapable of keeping up with all of the new content. Who could keep up with all this content, and frankly, who wants to? And so we're forced to resort to the two great enemies of seriousness, which are endemic in our contemporary education system. Number one, specialization, which forces us to know very much about extremely little, and technique, which enables us to know very little about extremely much. But efficiency and busyness are values of the machine and a machine age, and they grind imagination into the imagination of bolts and pulleys, computing and spitting out. Instead, refuse the tyranny of always needing to produce, of being a machine. Learn to waste time well. Go for a walk in the woods. Tell some bad jokes. Explore a used bookstore. Haunt a church. Idle a day away staring at beautiful things in boutiques you cannot afford. My own preference is for paper shops. Who would buy this paper? It is so expensive, but it is so beautiful. At some point in your life, such a waste of time will become indulgent, but not just yet. And above all, have a healthy respect for the Sabbath. It seems to me the university's disdain for Sabbath rest is a mark of the lack of the health of the university. Keep Sabbath. Third, liturgy. For Christians, imagination is formed primarily through story-formed community, which is to say through the narrative, images, and symbols of a worshiping community. Worship is the basic tool of formation that we have, and we all worship one way or the other, whatever our religious commitment or lack of religious commitment. The stories and images and narratives that we tell ourselves about the purpose of life is a form of worship. If our worship is self-centered, we will be self-centered. If our worship is entertainment and yet another form of consumerism, you will be an entertained consumer. If it is sentimental or kitschy, so too will your soul be sentimental and kitschy. If, on the other hand, liturgy presents us a majestic and noble God, you get the picture. Even the simple insistence to worship as our spiritual mothers and fathers worshiped is an imaginative act of profound humility and reverence for the community, and a resistance and discipline against an age of the novel and technique and advertising and spiritual gimmickry. Fourth, I suspect you're going to find my fourth suggestion hopelessly quaint. I think good communities spend a considerable amount of time teaching communal dance. I think universities that do not teach their students to dance are failing their students. Now, would you forgive me? How quaint, she says. Her words were, how quaint. Would you forgive me for quoting myself on a reflection I wrote after a night of dancing with my family and friends? Long quote, forgive me. Recently, my wife and some friends threw a party, culminating in traditional English line dancing. I'd not done that before, and I went to the party somewhat hesitant, thinking it was going to be sort of stupid. But there we all were, jammed together in an overheated room, stomping and clapping, bowing and twirling to the fiddle and the guitar. Mostly, though, we were exulting. I held my youngest daughter to her shrieking delight as her older sister and I do-si-do'd and promenaded, and a triumphant son somehow managed to convince an older and quite pretty partner to stoop down to his level. Unlike other days, teenage boys could not escape their mother's arms. I saw one mother so jubilant and merry and relieved at this fact that she seemed to paraphrase the Song of Simeon, "Lord, now let your servant depart in peace." Grandfathers danced with granddaughters. Husbands danced with estranged wives, or wives from whom they were estranged. Friends danced with friends. A few yearning adolescents with hearts beating time to another more ancient reel danced. In that sweltering, overcrowded room, you could hear the music and see us leaping, joined in circles, feet rising and falling in mirth, the association of man and women. If you know your Eliot, you know I'm cribbing Eliot there. Holding each other by the hand or arm. I was drunk with it, flushed of body and soul, delighted with the others, thrilled with reality. We were not, as I feared, ironical. We were, or skeptical, we were approving. We approved in the old sense of the term. We recognized goodness, probus, and we loved it. We willed that it should be, that it should exist, that it should continue. In the handing off of one partner to the next, we handed on, traditio, tradition, the rhythms of the good reality that preceded us, following the patterns long set down by others, and it was good. On another occasion, I was with several dozen members of my parish celebrating Oktoberfest. There was lederhosen and beer and a roasted pig and like an oompa-pa band. It was sort of corny. But my son was so proud. He was so roosterish as he led his older and younger sisters around the floor. Never mind that he knew not one of the steps, he danced out of joy. Most strikingly, my youngest wove and bounced her way around, joining eyes and hands with other dancers, somewhat willy-nilly, including people she did not know. Hers, in the way that a child's way can be, was a way of affirmation, a deep and childlike sense that all was well, all was well, all manner of things should be well, and thus she could keep the feasts. Now, such universal approval is hardly shallow optimism. It does not deny the tragic, but still, festivity, contemplation, wonder, delight, love lives in affirmation. Even the feasts for the dead depend on faith that all is well with the world. Such deep approval is first of all to be taken in the literal sense of the word's root, finding it to be good, approving, probus. It is a way of turning to him or her or it or the event and saying, it is good that you exist. It is good that you are in this world. Is that not what Adam says to Eve in that first moment? At last, it is good that you are here. And what do you want more than anything in the world than to have others say to you, it is good that you are here. It is good that you exist. That is the opposite of anxiety and pointlessness. I suspect for many of us, it is the opposite of the educational regime in which we've been formed, which has rarely told us it is good that you are here, but instead has asked you to prove yourself again and again and again, willing to withhold approval of you and your work at a moment's notice. We need better practices, practices which serve to form us as lovers, those capable in the words of Pieper of the affirmation of our own being, which is to say, to love. In the Christian understanding of the world, God is a communion of love, a mutuality of delight in the goodness of the other, with such mutuality that there's a shared being among the persons of the Godhead. We who are created in the image of God are meant for such loving communion, and we are meant for the free offering of ourselves, without which there cannot be communion with others. But we are already, and the world is already, a free gift of God to us, one that he delights in again and again. Our task in the world is not to accomplish things. Our task in the world is to love as God loves. Those are the great commandments, are they not? To love God, to love neighbors as ourselves, and to love others as God loves them. He tells us very little about accomplishment or racking up certificates on the wall. But we cannot do that unless and until we see things as lovely, as having a freshness deep down things, as Hopkins puts it. But so much of our culture is existentially poor, bereft, and barren, and it would love to have you be poor in this way as well. Our culture and much of our education encourages barrenness. It rewards barrenness. It tenures barrenness. It trains and reinforces barrenness. Our time is barren, I'm suggesting for your consideration, but I hope that you are not. And I hope that you, as you form the eyes of love, you will overcome that barrenness and live the life of love. Thank you. Okay, I promised it would be non-Thomistic, non-analytic. If you've read Aquinas, you know everything's very structured. These are meandering reflections. I'm happy to have your comments, your questions, your objections. Please don't hesitate.
How does one teach in a way that is good?
How does one teach in a way that is good?
In keeping with this, so students here, but let's say they go to teach, how would we do that?
Yes. This is a slight exaggeration, but I believe it's somewhat the case. Years ago, Josiah Bunting wrote a book called An Education for Our Time. And in it, it was a very fascinating story. He invents a mythical college somewhere out west. In the story, a billionaire gives money for a college, and they invent a college out west with a new educational program. So many people were so delighted by his vision of this college that people applied for jobs, even though it was a work of imaginative fiction. But in it, one of the tests that the administrators of the school would ask new faculty members or potential faculty members is the following. I may be misremembering the details, but something like this. What is it that you teach? Mathematics or biology or persons? And if they said biology, they didn't get the job. If they said persons, then they moved on to the next level. I think of teaching as an encounter between persons. I don't think of teaching as the transmission of information. And as the encounter between persons, one of the primary tasks of the teacher to teach well is to know and respect her pupils. So it's very difficult to respect pupils if you think of them as mere receivers of information, or if you think of them as merely attainment machines. But it's also incredibly difficult to teach students well if you don't know them. So to teach well, I think, requires a sense that what you're about is teaching persons, and you have to respect the persons whom you teach, and you have to know them. There's 1,000 ways to do that. You have a follow-up. Well, this is one of the difficulties, isn't it, that we only have people for a year, as opposed to an apprenticeship or an accompaniment or a real knowing of people over time. It's not very efficient, that the method I'm suggesting, but it is slightly more humane.
Thank you.
Please.
Do you have a tip for administrators?
As I recall, he did not really have administrators. He had faculty who served temporary appointments and then went back to the classroom, as I recall. As you know, universities are such large, complicated machines now that it's the old notion of faculty administering for a while and then sort of coming back to teaching is very unusual and very difficult to do any longer. But it's a mark that many universities are perhaps beyond proper scale, it seems to me. Please.
So earlier you talked about how education, like the purpose of education, is to cultivate or to like recultivate the sense of truth, goodness, and beauty. Why have we lost the sense of what those things are? Like, I think it's easy to just be like, oh, the culture, but like, what is it about the culture? Because it's things that we're all designed for and we all long for, like goodness, truth, and beauty. And we're wired for that, so how do we forget, or why do we know?
So the answer to that is very long, and there's a lot of different answers, and they all conflict. Different people have different accounts for this. It seems to me incredibly important if one looks at some of the founding documents of early modern understandings of what education is, that there is an sometimes implicit, but oftentimes explicit rejection of the notion of finality or teleology or purpose to study, to knowledge. So you see this in someone like Francis Bacon in the New Organon. You see this in Descartes' Method. You see this in Hobbes and others. What that means, it seems to me, is that when you study, when you learn, there's little sense that the things you're studying, the events, the persons, the objects, the organisms, the formulae, fit into a whole, and that each of these things in their own way have a kind of purpose, and to really understand that thing is to understand its purpose, as opposed to understanding the mechanisms or causal forces which bring that thing into existence or allow it to function in its own way. As a result, what we study increasingly is merely the system of causes, as opposed to a system of wholeness or perfection or full act or purpose. But once you no longer consider as an explicit purpose or maybe even a primary purpose of study, the notion of the purpose of a thing, it's very difficult to recognize how truth would be understood as anything other than sort of proper arrangement of factoids, or how goodness would be anything other than a sort of proper arrangement of procedures, as opposed to the fulfillment of a thing's being, or how beauty would be a relevant category at all. You remember Aquinas says that the true, the good, the beautiful, and the one are all the same thing. They're just being and understood in different modes of apprehension. So the true is just being as it's known, the good is just is being as it's desired, and the beautiful is just being as it causes delight or as it's delighted in. Once you disintegrate being into chunks of causal forces, it's very difficult to imagine if you ever get to a picture of being recognized as beautiful, being recognized as true, being recognized as good. Those of you studying ethics, for instance, I imagine that a whole lot of times when you study ethics, you focus on the good or the right, and the beautiful rarely enters into the conversation, which Thomas would have thought of absolutely incoherent. Imagine an ethics which did not cause delight. If you know your Aristotle,
the person does an act of virtue, but it does not cause them delight. Are they virtuous? No. Of course not. You're only virtuous when the good is also a source of pleasure for you. But that makes sense in a vision of knowledge where it hangs together. It's the form of the thing and the finality of the thing are fundamentally the same. There's more to it than that. I think that's an important bit of the story. It's not the only bit of the story at all. Please.
Thank you so much for your remarks. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the difference between learning the teaching of liberal arts in a sacred versus secular environment. Do you think there's sort of a unique benefit to learning in a secular environment in that you're not allowed to sort of download dogma and sort of foreshorten the dialectical process of coming to truth in a very basic, you have to go through the basic fundamental premises?
Well, I don't think anyone's allowed to download dogma, right? So you said it yourself in your introduction. For Thomas, there's an integration of faith and reason. That doesn't mean that dogma solves problems that are not understood. So you remember the old notion that faith seeks understanding, fides quorum intellectum. Faith is not the end of reason or the end of dialectic; it's the starting point of dialectic. It's the starting point of thought. It's not the ending point. Now, that's not different than in kind, different in the level of certainty. Remember your Thomas, faith is more certain than reason, because faith is the authority of God. So if it would not be different in kind, it would be different in its level of certainty. From the various dogmas or methods or procedures of any discipline of study. Right? I myself don't tend to think that knowledge begins in a vacuum, it begins within a tradition, begins within a discipline. A canon of rationality or a pattern or a set of data points, something that's accepted for the discipline to be its discipline, and that's the starting point of conversation. And that starting point sometimes then is falsified or retracted or goes back on itself, right? It's not sort of done forever, but there's still a starting point of conversation. It's not different in kind, I don't think, than dogma. So I would push on the basic assumption of the question. Now, is it easier to do this in a secular environment or not? I suppose if by secular we mean simply a kind of acceptance of pluralism where all forms of rationality are welcome to the table to argue, as opposed to the kind of secularism which is in fact a negation of religious reasons and that which insists that you have to preclude or set to the side religious reasons, because that's no longer secular in a neutral sense. That's a positive anti-theism. And that ought to be rejected as being not just unfair, but irrational. All reasons available should be invited into the conversation. So if that's what we mean, sure. Nobody wants to poke fun at my dancing?
Rejoice in the work that we're doing, or if friends that see their work in drudgery, what are some concrete ways that you can rejoice in the work?
Sometimes there's just drudgery in the world. I've graded more than my fair share of papers which have begun with something like, philosophers since the beginning of time, wondering, oh yes, here we go. Sometimes there's just drudgery to the work. As a parent, sometimes there's just drudgery at cleaning up the dishes, doing the diapers, and so on. At the same time, if the universe is not flat and without purpose fundamentally, the universe is fundamentally, as I believe, created by a good and generous God, who offers all things to us as an opportunity. I don't believe that there's a blueprint where God makes everything happen to us. I think everything which does happen to us, God permits to happen, at least, even if he doesn't actively will and direct it. It means that everything that we do, everything that we encounter, everything that we engage, is another occasion by which God is offering to us his friendship and his communication. He is seeking to impart something to himself in whatever happens to us, even those things that he does not directly will to happen to us. His agency is such that he can bring good out of it. So one sits down to the drudgery. You sat down to the drudgery. Yes? What is available to you in that drudgery is yet again the offering of God's friendship. Is it drudgery now? What's on offer here
is conformity. Is an invitation to conformity with the will of God and the offering of God's own friendship to you. Just now in this. St. Ignatius of Loyola had a practice called the examine. Totally different from the examination of conscience. Some of you may be familiar with that at the end of the day. Sort of run through your day. What did I do good today? What did I do bad today? The list goes on longer. What can I do for tomorrow's resolution? That's the examination of conscience. The examine was an attempt to pay attention to the ways that God was trying to speak to you today, particularly through your emotions and particularly through your negative emotions, moments of jealousy or rage or frustration or what have you, right? What did you miss of God attempting to communicate to you just then? Now, the exam is an incredibly powerful exercise to sort of attune one's sense of sight and attune one's sense of hearing, to see the goodness, the dearest freshness deep down things. And it changes the whole economy, the whole story, the whole purpose of the thing. Right? If I can get up in the middle of the night to deal with a crying child, because I can convince myself or acknowledge or recognize that this too is the attempt of God to befriend me, that's different from I'm getting up to make this kid be quiet so I can get back to sleep, or I'm getting up to please my wife so that she'll be nice to me tomorrow, or whatever. And suddenly it's a different story entirely. Everything's that way. There's nothing, not nothing, that can't be recognized and received as an offering of God's goodness, even things which are themselves unjust and God does not will. Understand the distinction? God's not willing this for us. And yet, even in it, God can do it better. Please, Stephen.
I wanted to ask what you think of it. Do you think a liberal education can only be found in the humanities? Like, half the school is not taking philosophy, English, history, theology, and maybe very cynical about looking up the list of great books and, you know, reading Shakespeare in their free time, and are actually happy with their course of study, like physics or pre-med, and they do find that there's a good in the goal that they've chosen.
Yeah, no, I don't think, nor do I think the tradition of Western education has thought that the humanities were the domain and sole domain of liberal education. Plato certainly doesn't think that in the Republic when he gives his account, right? We have mathematics and we have a kind of geometry in that account. The trivium and the quadrivium go far beyond what we would think of as just the traditional humanities. And certainly in the contemporary university, we're not going to revert back to the trivium and the quadrivium. We're just sort of beyond that in complexity now. Nor do I think the liberal arts are the domain of English and philosophy, or fill in the blank. What is it that an engineer studies? Well, an engineer studies many things, including mathematics, including matter, including form, including order and pattern and relationship. Those are the same things that the liberal arts study, even if it's the questions being asked are not existential questions, like what is the meaning of life? That which is being studied is what Augustine calls number and form, which he thinks is something like the study of the nature of God. There's three people in my life who I think are the best liberally educated people I know. One is 85 years old and graduate from Princeton. He did his senior thesis under the wonderful Walter Kaufmann on the work of Wagner, and he became a chemist. Trained himself to teach to play the violin so well that members of the Philadelphia Orchestra come to his home to play with him. He taught himself art collecting so well that the Philadelphia Museum of Art is full of pieces of his collection. In the summers, he goes to great books camps to read Aeschylus and Sophocles. At like 82, he tried to learn Greek. That's one. The second one, a gentleman's about 68, he's a finance guy. He has enough time that he has now for about 25 years, driven from Philadelphia to Princeton to precept. Princeton doing large lecture classes that broke me out into study groups or text groups where you sort of work through the text in smaller sessions. He has no need to do this in 25 years. He's made the drive from Philadelphia to Princeton once or twice a week so he can continue to teach texts, most of which he did not study before. Third, maybe 45 years old, very successful Wall Street banker who recruits students from universities because he thinks that finance, as he does it, is the fulfillment of the liberal arts. They're looking for businesses that are run by intelligent people who are devoted to their employees and devoted to the product and who have invested sufficient amount of their energy and maintain a sufficient amount of stock that they believe they can trust these people to make sound decisions. So he's investing in, he's hiring people who he thinks are good at reading people's commitments. How does he do this? He studies humanity. He reads Shakespeare more than he reads the Financial Times, he tells me. He's probably exaggerating the point. But I don't think there's any reason that the liberal arts are the domain of English and history and psychology. I think all can be studied in that mode.
And how would you develop a contemplative mindset if you never encountered a teacher
Everyone wants contemplation right now. So I wager you that if we go to the Cavalier bookstore, or we go to the local Barnes & Noble, or whatever bookstores are in town, we can, in a matter of minutes, find at least four books or cover stories in magazines that have the word mindfulness on it. Right? Why? Some of you are smirking because you're familiar with this phenomenon, right? You walk in the bookstore, mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness. That's fine. What is it that people are looking for? The ability to be present to the task which is at hand, yes? My own sense of contemplation includes that, the ability to attend to that which is at hand. But more than mindfulness, to recognize the goodness that's on offer in that. But those sorts of things can be taught. Those sorts of things can be trained. Those sorts of things can also just be habituated. You just have to do it. Like most intellectual virtues, they're not infused. You know that you remember your old Thomistic distinction between acquired and infused virtues? Acquired virtues are like natural virtues that one gets by doing the thing over and over and over and over again until one day you can do it. As opposed to an infused virtue, which is generally a gift of grace, which you don't acquire through your own efforts, but which is given to you and which you can then cooperate with once you have it. Oddly. I'm not sure you have it, really. It seems to me that contemplation is an acquired virtue, not an infused virtue. You just do it. Waste some time, well, read some better books, dance well with friends. I don't know, what else did I say? Those things. Sorry? Yeah, do literally. That's what that stuff's for. That's why we do it. Thank you for remembering my talk better than that. Do we have time for more questions or are we done? One more. Please.
I wondered if you would clarify what you mean by doing something for its own sake. I remember you were talking about feasting, but you started off by saying how, when it's a big feast, like you feast with St. Joseph, you feast. But then I guess when you put it that way, it sounds like you're feasting for St. Joseph, so it has a purpose, so it's not for its own sake. Yeah, if you just clarify what you mean.
Yeah, thanks. So there's going to be ancillary benefits for things that we do for their own sake. That's not why we do that. So in instrumental goods are things that we do not do because it is good to do them per se. They're things that we do for some benefit or result that they bring about. So if you remember the opening, some of the opening passages of the Nicomachean Ethics, where we describe this hierarchy of activities that we do. We do this for the sake of this, for the sake of this, for the sake of this. And if we didn't get to this, we wouldn't do any of these intermediary steps. An intrinsic good, or an act done for its own sake, is one that one does for no other reason than it is good to do. Right? I come home from work and I have this little 2-year-old who runs at me and I pick her up and throw her into the air. Why? I'm hoping she'll love me enough to care for me when I'm aged and decrepit. Yes? That's why I do it. I have other children that I love for their own sake. Her? No. One does it for no other reason than it is good to do. Now, does it cause joy? Does it cause friendship? Does it alleviate tensions in the, between members of the family, that sort of thing? Yeah, it does. That's not why one does it. Think of feasts where people are trying to do the feast precisely to bring about results. You know, the sort of painfully awkward networking parties that student organizations will do, and they're like, come make friends. You know, you show up, you get a little red cup, standing in the corner, hoping simultaneously that someone will notice you, and B, that no one will notice that you were there because it's so horrifying and awkward and unpleasant. You've been to those parties where everyone is trying to have fun, and so it is no fun. As opposed to something you do for its own sake, because you want to. Lewis says somewhere in the Screwtape Letters that, John, one demon writing to another demon about how to lose souls, I guess, as opposed to win souls. And the elder demon is condemning the younger demon because he's allowed his patient to do something that he just enjoyed doing. Like, he allowed his patient to read a book just because he wanted to and thought it was a fun book, even though it wasn't the right kind of book. Like, it wasn't the New Yorker hadn't told you to read it, he just read it because he wanted to. And that could save your soul because it was a source of delight. To my wife's great astonishment and somewhat irritation, I have over the last several months, every night, just been reading the Patrick O'Brien Vehicle series, all 21 vol, 20 minute and a half volumes before you die. And she'll look at her and say, again, still? You're reading this sort of ridiculous male soap opera with swashbuckling pirates? Yes, and it's amazing. And it's keeping me out of trouble. Wendell Berry talks about work that way. About working, which, yeah, there's things that you need to do. You need to get this job done. And then you realize you're doing it just because it's fun. There can be ancillary benefits. The point is not the benefit. I'm very grateful for your time. Thank you for spending a little bit of it with me.